All right, everybody, thanks for joining us. Today is the Power Hour. It's going to go quick. We're only able to do 1 hour today. So I would jump in right now. If you don't press one on your phone pretty soon, you're probably not going to get through. But if you do it right now, you've got a shot. We're going to go ahead and get started.
Your taxes, your truck, and your road to success in the trucking industry.
This is Trucking Business and Beyond, the show that puts the money where it belongs,
back in your pocket.
Welcome to my world. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. The show is all about the business of trucking, and today is the Power Hour. We'll take your calls and answer your questions about everything maintenance, engines, performance, fuel mileage, modifications, upgrades, troubleshooting, emissions, new technology, you name it. We'll talk about it. All you have to do is pick up the phone and call. We're going to get to those calls in a little bit. I want to bring in the guys from Pittsburgh Power. We've got Bruce and John and Ethan joining us today. Hey, guys, welcome back.
Thank you for having us, Kevin. It's always a pleasure.
Yeah, it's good to be here, Kevin. Yeah, good to be here, Kevin.
All right. So what's new and exciting at Pittsburgh Power these days?
Well, you know, last week I told you about a generator set we had with a K-Series Cummins. That's a 19-liter. It had very, very low hours on it in case somebody has a hunting camp or a group of hunting camps and they want to power up a small town. Today, we have another machine with a KTA 600 in it. It only has 150 hours on it. It's a snow blower, and it'll blow snow 300 feet. Came out of the Detroit airport. It was a backup machine. They no longer used it. Private contractor bought it, and they have three of them, and they're not using it. This can be bought for $30,000. Now, somebody wants the machine will go along at 50 miles an hour, so you'd have to haul it home. But you can get yourself a great KTA 600 Cummins for $30,000, and that's a pretty good deal.
Bruce, I'm thinking that for $30,000, I might want it because I could accomplish two things at once. I could clear my driveway and piss off all the neighbors because I'll blow it into their driveway.
You could do your whole community, and you could do, is that I-84 you're on? No.
Yeah, 84.
What's your interstate?
Yeah. Yep, 84.
You could do part of the interstate. You could do a whole lot of the interstate with this snowblower. I think the vane on it stands about 5 feet tall. So,
but see, Bruce, if I get out there on 84 with it, what I'm going to do is not use it to clear the highway. I'm going to go down, you know, about 2 miles away from my house in either direction and use it to pile up snow to close the highway.
Why? Why do you want to do that?
Well, because it's nice and peaceful when they close the highway down because of all the fire. So quiet. Nobody was driving into town, and you know.
Now, keep in mind, you knew that interstate was there when you bought that property.
Yeah, and honestly, I don't really hear it anyway, but it sounds like it'd be fun.
All right, and Ethan's going to talk about wiring harnesses, and here's a situation where you're damned if you do and damned if you don't. All the electronic engines have wires under the valve covers, and they're in the hot oil. And when you're rebuilding the engine, you add several hundred dollars to the price of a rebuild by always replacing that harness. But when the truck pulls in, sometimes the harness is fine. And when it leaves, it might run for a month, might run for 6 months, and then the harness fails. So we're going to start replacing all these harnesses under valve covers. And then I was talking to Ethan and John about that this morning, and Ethan came up and started mentioning the failures we're seeing in some Caterpillar harnesses. So I'm going to turn that over to Ethan.
Yeah, the Caterpillar harness, well, it fails differently than a Detroit harness does. It's also a little bit more expensive to replace, but when you're in the process of doing an in-frame or a rebuild, it makes the most sense because you're going to save time and labor. Because doing the rebuild itself costs, you know, you already have to disassemble half of the wiring harness to begin with, and everything's out of your way, which for once, it makes it really easy to route the harness. The cat harnesses tend to fail in a way where they get hot, and then the wires will slowly melt towards each other is what they like to do. And eventually they short out, and they just get brittle. And Caterpillar designed these harnesses not to be fixed. They use like a hard plastic white mesh loom. Anybody who owns a cat knows what it looks like there. And then when you see that happening where, you know, they end a couple inches before where the sensor would plug in, if you can see it there, it's happening underneath the harness. And once you see it in one spot, it's everywhere almost. So it's at that time, I think the Cat one, that they're about $1,100 or so for two of them. But when you're going to cut the labor down when it's already apart, and rather than it take 4 hours, you're at an hour and a half or 2 hours, you're going to have to do it again anyway. And a good inspection of them when it's apart is, you know, very imperative. Because if you start to see signs of the wear, you just moved all the wires, they might have been happy before, but just moving them back and forth that one time was all it took to make it, you know, a short.
John, you had said something. What did some electrician you spoke with said that it's called whenever they jump signals?
Oh, they call it leakage. It's voltage leakage. Yeah, if the insulation breaks down a little bit, or if they're bundled real close together, they'll actually leak across to each other. Especially the cat. I don't know what the current is, but they're 100 volts to go to those injectors. So
yeah.
So you know, if they're bundled tightly or tied tightly to the intermediate plate as they are, and that plastic heat cycles, you know, many times and gets little harder every time. What it does is you'll get some leakage across the wires. So they'll actually, you know, you'll have voltage in one that'll actually bleed some voltage into the other, which will cause all kinds of crazy stuff with your engine.
Now, we've even seen it where on the cat wiring harness, on the injector harness, if it gets pinched in shipping, that will be the end of that one, because that 90-degree pinch actually broke the wire inside. And even if half the strands are still together, the other half are arcing and will just, you know, eventually part the wire on both sides. And you typically get a little bubble under the wire, and it looks funny, almost like it has a growth on it. And if you cut it with the razor, it'll just fall into two pieces.
Ethan, have you ever seen where the wiring harness has caused two injectors to fire at the same time, causing a miss?
It is very possible. It's just that they have to short together. So depending on the engine, yes. And it'll throw code for that typically. And the ECMs are smart enough to know that voltage is doing that, and it'll actually shut the other cylinders down. So it doesn't want to see a voltage when it's not supposed to, because the circuit boards have a current monitor in them, and it will tell it, hey, I've got current on this line when I shouldn't, and it'll shut the cylinder off to try to prevent it from damaging the ECM.
Okay. All right. Kevin, that's all
right.
We have.
Well, it looks like we have time to jump into a call and get started. So let's do that. Let's go to Kansas. Jeff, welcome to the program.
Hey, guys. Always enjoy the show. Had a question about, the PACCAR motors. They seem to be in, you know, trucks that, you know, have half a million miles on them at a little bit of a discounted price, but you know, not real confident about the differences of them. I run a Cummins ISX, a CM870, so it's kind of the devil that I know at this point. And I haven't heard you guys, I've heard you mention some things about it, going to the factory and everything, but I'm just wondering if you guys have gone a little further along, things to look for, if you would even consider, if you'd even consider one of those engines as a small operator, you know, a single truck owner operator. And I guess, on the back of that question, you know, these Mercedes engines seem to be really, really cheap. I wonder if there's anything to do worth, you know, considering, you know, can those be saved at all? So, yeah, those are my questions.
John?
I wouldn't be afraid of the, you know, especially at the discounted price. I personally would not be at all afraid of the PACCAR, particularly a 13 or newer. The 12 and under I'd probably stay away from. They just made some improvements to the 2013 and up. It went to a standard Bosch Common Rail system, fuel injection system, whereas the previous one had 6 unit pumps that that controlled the fueling, and that those were known to be problematic, and it's just more moving pieces to go bad. But the common rail engines, the 13 up, I guess the GHG 14, right, or the EPA 14 and
yeah,
up, is when they went to the common rail, and I've heard very little problems with those. They're not particularly tunable yet. We're still working on that. I've been struggling to get the Dorothy to work on it. I'm working on a higher flow model right now to get that up and running. The earlier one, we were able to make a Dorothy work on. That worked really well. But the 13 and up, we're still working on. But I would not be afraid of one of those at all, especially at the discounted price.
All right. We've got to get to a break. We'll be right back with more stuff. Stick around. Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. This is the Power Hour. I've got Bruce and Ethan and John with me from Pittsburgh Power. We're going to get right back to your calls. We're off to Georgia this time. Steve, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. And again, I am enjoying the show today. I have a 09 Freightliner Cascadia with a DD15, and I want to what's going on is the, I guess you call it the XY shifter on top of the transmission. It gets where it throws a fault code. And what I can do is that I can take and tap the front motor on the XY shifter, and it begins to work again. And so I'm going to change the XY shifter tomorrow. And kind of did a little research on it, and it seemed like a simple fix as far as taking 4 bolts out, and it pops up as long as it's in neutral. And my question is anything I should be concerned about in changing that XY shift on that transmission?
Just make sure you don't get any dirt down in there. The dirt tends to lay up on the top of it. You'll need the gasket with it, too. And then if
right.
I can remember right, there's like 3 little springs too. Make sure they don't stick or fall.
The detent springs.
Yeah, on the front of the XY shifter. Other than that, right. No, I think there's 6 bolts and.
Yep, or 4 even.
4 gasket, yeah. And then the little spring.
Right, just watch the detent springs are going to want to pop up out of the transmission housing. Be really careful that you don't lose one of those and have it fall down into the transmission. So when you initially pick it up, the gasket's probably going to have it stuck, so pry it gently and keep a little pressure on it with your hand. Don't let it come flying off. And then pick it up and make sure that there should be 3 or...
I think there's 3.
3 springs will be sticking straight up. And make sure you don't lose those. And check all your wiring connections, too. Just make sure you've got, clean up. Use a little dielectric grease on the plug-ins and make sure that all works good. And that doesn't need to be wedded to the TCU or anything? Okay.
No, that works. Just plug and play.
Yeah, it should be pretty easy.
Okay. All right. I do appreciate it so much.
You're welcome. Thanks for all. Let's head off to Texas. Dixie, welcome to the program.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for taking my call. I just got a 2016 Cascadia. It's the 12-speed auto shift and very new to me, all foreign. I felt like country coming to town. And I'm just wondering, with the auto shift, obviously I can put it in the manual, but in driving it, it does fairly well. I was surprised on the hills. I do mostly mountains and hills, a lot of the regional in Washington, Idaho, Oregon, Utah. So I'm wondering is there a point like running the hills and the mountains that I need to put it in manual or just keep it in automatic? When I had my foot pressed to the floor getting up the hill, it at one point it clicked on its own and then it downshifted. So I assume there, obviously I can do it in the foot, but I mean, am I driving it? I'm just wondering if I'm driving it right, getting the full benefit out of this auto shift, because I've never been in one before. So I'm just kind of seeing what you, your ideas, if I'm driving it right or there's another way to drive it, et cetera.
Well, I've read about this transmission. I've got no experience personally with it. I've not driven a truck with one in it, and nor have I even talked to many people here who, we haven't seen one in the shop, have we?
I have not seen one yet.
But I must say, with all the research I've done on it, let it do its thing. It knows if you're going up a hill or not. There's GPS built into it that reads off of the computer. It knows where it needs to be. Unless something feels or sounds really wrong, I would let it do its thing and get some data on it. You know, run it for a while. You know, get to know your truck a little bit better. Let it do its thing. And see what happens. But I think that you're going to be hard pressed to do anything better than it's going to do itself from everything I've read about that transmission.
Okay, yeah, that's so, basically what I'm.
And Dixie, I agree with John. We don't know enough about this, but I've done the same thing. I've read everything. It looks like they've got the technology down on this that you can kind of let the transmission do its own thing, and you're going to get really good fuel economy. But the other thing that I would recommend is get yourself a scan gauge KR and experiment both ways. Let the truck drive itself up the hill and watch what your fuel economy is doing, and then hit a similar hill and flip it over to manual and see if you could outdrive it. And that may be a really good comparison to find out which one's going to work better.
Okay, yeah, that is on my list, and so I was thinking of that myself. I mean, so I was surprised this 12-speed automatic and that the power that it does seem to have without having to shift down and this, that, and the other. I mean, it's a nice truck, and you're just getting used to everything, very new to me, so I will do that. And one other quick question, with the aerodynamics of this Freightliner, things like the air tabs and the flow below, is that something? I mean, I know the air tabs work like with spray, but with the aerodynamics already with this truck and all of that, should I still be doing stuff like that?
Absolutely.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, Dixie, when you look at the super truck models that they're creating, that is the single biggest thing they still address. Aerodynamics are the single biggest drag on fuel economy, and every improvement we can make in aerodynamics is going to improve fuel economy. So the flow below is a great addition. The Freightliner Evolution was very aerodynamic, but they recently added the flow below as a factory on that truck, because again, every aerodynamic improvement we make is just cumulative.
Yes, my thoughts as well. And I, this one is the evolution, but it didn't come with the flow below. And then they've got the hood mirrors. I don't need the hood mirrors. I was going to take those off. To me, that's just a drag, yes?
There is some drag there. There's no question. The new designs are a lot better. I this is a personal preference, but I really like the hood mirrors. I'm willing to give up the probably 10th of a mile per gallon they're costing just because of convenience and safety. Just being able to glance, you know, I don't even have to turn my head, just glance my eyes to either mirror. I see everything's clear. So it's a personal preference. They will cost you a little bit of fuel economy, but the mirrors on that Evolution are pretty well designed.
Okay, great. Well, thank you. Love the show and appreciate all that you guys do for us. So thank you.
All right. Thanks. John, okay. Anything to add on the aerodynamics there?
No, I'm a believer in all of it. The flow below in particular is really nice. And I haven't seen pretty much all the new Freightliners I'm seeing out on the road have that on there. That's one thing that's really taken off. I see it everywhere, the flow below really. And it makes a ton of sense. I'm all for it. I like the wheel covers, too, and I'm partial to the smart truck approach to under trailer, personally. I think that they get it right, the way they speed up the air and push it under the axle to help fill in the void behind. I think that's more clever to me than the skirting that you see going up and down the sides. I think it solves a bigger problem at the back of the truck.
And in a much better way. You know, you don't have the damage, you don't have the restrictions of the skirts trying to get down into, you know, deep docks. And I don't know if you've ever seen it or not. I posted this a long time ago. I may have to pull this back up. Smart Truck had somebody install the under tray on their trailer, and they showed a picture where a driver was trying to do a U-turn in a road. And, you know, when you really, really turn tight, the trailer actually starts backing up. And he backed the tandems off of about a 4-foot high retention wall. And the trailer dropped completely onto the under tray system. It was completely smashed, flattened when you saw the picture of it. And then they had to get a crane in there and lift the trailer back up. And when they did, they were able to pop the Smart Truck system right back into shape. You couldn't tell anything ever happened to it.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah, yeah. It's made of ABS plastic. I wonder if they just pressurized it a little bit and popped it into shape.
Yeah, so the other thing that's interesting right now that I want to see is Flow Below now has a trailer modification for the trailer tandems. The same thing, kind of the dog bone in between the two. And the fairing, so it'd be interesting to see how well those two might play together. That may give you a very, very effective aerodynamic treatment on a trailer. I'm going to get to a break. We'll come back. We'll talk about that and get to more of your calls and questions right after this. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. This is the Power Hour. I've got Bruce and Ethan and John with me from Pittsburgh Power. John, Here's another big advantage I see to Smart Truck that a lot of people don't think about. In racing, would you ever let 3 or 4 or 5 different companies work on aerodynamic treatments without talking to each other and design them completely on their own and then put all 4 of them on the truck and hope that they played well together?
Absolutely not. You know, maybe a smart engineer might pick a few things from a couple of different companies, like we thought about, you know, put the flow below filler between the wheels with the coupled with the Smart Truck. But, you know, we refer to it as the package. It's an aerodynamic package and it all kind of works together. So, you know, on the race cars, we'll have an under tray that works well with a specific rear wing that works well with, and it all works in concert. So it's going to be the same thing on the truck. So you can't take differing philosophies and make them work together. Like the belly treatment on the Smart Truck would definitely do nothing with one of those fold out deals you put on the back of the truck. You know, that's going to actually be a problem. You're going to stuff air inside of it because they're actually, you know, speeding up the air to fill up the void behind the truck to keep from creating such a negative pressure back there. And coupled with their back of truck treatment, which is really simple, works quite well. But you wouldn't want to couple that, you know, with one of the trailer tails. The trailer tails work fine if you've got the side skirting. That's terrific. I mean, that's going to be better than not having it for sure. But yeah, so those are 2 things you would definitely not want to couple. But yeah, you don't do that. That's a no-no.
Yeah, and that's really what we're doing on trailers. We have, you know, 15 companies producing side skirts, and what a lot of people don't realize is everything about that side skirt could affect the airflow. Which angle they cut the back or the front at, how long it goes, how close it comes to the tandems, that all affects the airflow. And you've got all these different versions out there. Most of them haven't even been tested. They're just, you know, put side skirts on, you pass the requirements. Then we have a couple different, you know, boat tail, trailer tail kind of solutions. Again, they're doing things a little differently. We have, you know, different nose cone treatments. And possibly somebody throwing air tabs, and pretty soon you've got a mess. I mean, you don't have any idea what's happening to the airflow with all that stuff. And the beauty of Smart Truck is they've been at this a lot of years, and every new component they released is designed to fit into the way you called it, the package. That piece has been designed to feed air or to take air from their other pieces and keep the air moving the way we want it to move.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. Those guys are racers like me, so I get it. So Steve there is an ex-SCCA racer, and actually he's gone as far as IndyCar. That fellow's engineered IndyCars himself. So they're really, really smart guys. They come out of the aerodynamics world. I know that there's at least one ex-pilot or pilot there. So they really get the aero, I think, better than anybody else I've ever met. Another interesting thing, when I was at the NACFI thing in Indy back in the spring of last year, Mark Moore was there, who runs one of the wind tunnels in Indy, and he's almost completely focused on big truck stuff now. And Mark is an ex Indy Lights team owner. So he's another racing refugee out there working in trucks right now. But he does some really cool aero research there. And, you know, you can stop by and see him. He's not a full size one, though. I can't fit a whole truck in, but he's modeled many of these things. And he's got he's got models of numerous semis with different aero packages on them that he's run in this, in the wind tunnel there.
Where is the wind tunnel?
It is off of Guyon Road in the northwest corner of Indianapolis, so north of the Speedway, and within I-465 there. The name of the tunnels is escaping me right now. I forget the name of it. But Mark's a really clever guy, and he's done, you know, plenty of aero modeling, and he's done, you know, like I said, they've built numerous wind tunnel models, and they've tried different packages. But really, really informative. He gave a nice talk at the NACFI thing.
Yeah, I'd love to see some of that, because there isn't a lot of wind tunnel testing going on with trucks. It's outrageously expensive. There aren't that many wind tunnels that can handle them anyway. So any work like that would be really interesting to see. You know, the next step in that, this that we don't see a lot of in the industry, but you see it more in these super truck programs, is designing the tractor and trailer together. We almost ignore that completely. And that is a big part of this. You want the trailer designed to accept the airflow coming off the tractor, and you want the tractor designed to optimize the airflow, you know, based on what the trailer design is.
Yeah, absolutely.
So still a lot of work
again
to do there, but that's
a package
because there's, yeah, and there's a lot of fuel economy still to be gained there. So let's get back to some phone calls. Let's go to Tennessee. Craig, welcome to the program.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call. I've got a 1999 Volvo with a 60 Series Detroit. Kevin, it's your old truck.
Oh, okay.
I have an ECM issue, possibly.
Actually, it's my truck itself, or just like it?
It is your old truck.
Okay, got it. Okay. So, Bruce, just so you know, this is the ECM that you guys program.
Okay, good.
When I'm driving, I can be going through the gears, holding the, it's got an auto shift in it, and I can be holding the accelerator pedal steady, and it'll be going through the gears, and say when it gets to about third or fourth or fifth gear, all of a sudden, it'll take off like it just gained about 50% or something like that power, without me changing the position of the accelerator pedal, almost like it, the program changed or something. Is that even a possibility with that, or is that going to be more like a throttle control issue?
Okay, between what gears does that happen? Is that going from the low side to the high side in the transmission?
It seems like it can happen in any gear, really. It doesn't seem like it's it matters.
I thought you just said you're like in third and fourth gear or something.
Well,
so in other words, this is a 10-speed, correct?
It is a 10-speed auto shift.
So if you're in eighth gear and you're holding steady on a grade, would it accelerate by itself?
No, it's usually, it usually only happens one time, and it's usually not long after first startup. And once that happens, the accelerator seems to stick. The RPMs, if you mash the accelerator, the RPMs seem to want to stick and are slow to fall.
Sounds like it's got air in it to me, but
it could be air.
Question is, do you have a Kevin Rutherford's gain gauge in the truck by any chance?
I do.
Whenever this happens, you said it's prone to happening fairly early when you start your day there, put on the throttle position what the ECM sees. And when it happens, look what the scan gauge is saying versus where you think your foot is at. Because if you know you're only at about half pedal and the scan gauge jumps, then it's not, the ECM is getting an improper reading.
The scan gauge shows a normal reading. It doesn't change, except unless I move the accelerator pedal. But if I'm holding it steady and I get that burst of power, the throttle position still shows that it's in the same percentage.
Okay. And there's no codes being thrown?
Not for that, no. There aren't any codes. That was a the last thing I had checked at one of the local Detroit shops down here. I just wonder if there could be anything in the DCM program that could affect that.
We will talk about that more right around the corner. I've got to get to a break. Stick around. We've got more stuff. This is the Power Hour. I'm Kevin Rutherford. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. This is the Power Hour. I've got Bruce and Ethan and John with me from Pittsburgh Power. We're going to go back to Craig. Go ahead, guys.
Okay.
We were just having a small discussion about it here.
Yeah.
We think the best route would be to put a test ECM on it, take it for a ride. It'll eliminate the ECM or if it's a wiring issue at this point.
Okay.
Can you get the truck to our shop?
I probably could, or I could. I guess I could FedEx the ECM.
We'd like to have the whole truck and go for a ride and feel that.
Oh yeah, and install it, and just install one and test it like that.
Yeah. Okay. First, we'd like to go for a ride and see what you're feeling.
I see.
But I want you to make sure it's not when you're going from low range to high range.
Right. I tell you, it's odd, too. Since this colder weather, it's kind of quit doing it. So
There you go. The winter truck.
It's a sporadic it's a sporadic issue. Okay.
Interesting.
Maybe I can get by there in the next couple months.
All right. Let us know.
Sounds like a plan. Let's go to Iowa. Gary, welcome to the program.
Hi, guys. Say, I'm looking at a 1995. It's a FLD with a N14 10, and a 10-speed, has a new turbo. The engine has under 300,000 on an end frame. And I'm wondering, it's only got 372 horse, and I was wondering if that could be boosted up. And I'm wondering, what's the difference between a 1995 N14 versus a 2000 N14?
Well, the 95 is a Select, and the 2000 is a Select Plus. And the Select is a good engine. And the power box works very, very well on a Select. So I wouldn't be afraid of that. The ECM, I wonder if, Ethan, you know if that ECM can go up to 500, 5.25?
It would go by the CPL, but the highest Select is a 500, but you would have to know your CPL, and I don't believe the 370 horsepower falls in that range. It might be able to go to 430, but the power box would, you know, work wonders on that one.
And we have to check the CPL to see if that engine has aluminum pistons, because that could have aluminum.
Okay, what is the CPL?
That stands for Control Parts List. And that is on the data tag that's up in front of the accessory drive on the driver's side. You have your fuel pump, your air compressor, and your accessory drive, and it's on that side of that front cover. and the engine serial number is on there, and the CPL, control parts list number, is on there.
Okay.
Let's hope you have an 1844, but I doubt the 1844 was a 460-500, and that was a really great engine.
Okay, yeah, I found this truck for about $5,000.
And the total miles, you say, is what?
The miles on the actual truck are around 1 million, but he has 300,000 on a in-frame. And it has a brand new turbo. I am just buying it as a project truck and see what I'm going to do with it. I'm currently driving my classic that I turned into an FLD. Basically, I got rid of the dual stacks and stuff like that. I'm close to 7 miles to the gallon with this.
Oh, wow. Good.
But
well, for $5,000, sounds like a good deal.
Yeah, pretty hard to beat those kind of trucks. Sounds like that'll be solid. Let's go to Georgia. Mike, welcome to the program.
Hi, guys. Great show again. I just wanted to run by you there. I've got a five-month-old reconditioned transmission in a 2000 Freightliner. And I noticed in the last month now, when I go from fifth into sixth, it's going into the position, but it won't connect. So nothing's happening. It's like being in neutral.
Ooh.
Yeah, and if there's no codes for this in the
ECM. No. Not that I can see.
Is
this
an auto shift or a manual?
It's a manual. It's a 10-speed manual.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you've got a mechanical problem in the transmission. Yeah.
You probably think it's in the transmission itself?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, unless the shifter is really worn out. But I got to believe that there's a thrust bearing there that's allowing the dog ring to not quite make it to the gear whenever you shift into fifth.
Yeah, to go to the high range.
Right.
So even though it's only it's reconditioned like 4 or 5 months ago.
Take it back to the people that reconditioned it.
Yeah, well, I can take it back to who installed it for me. I mean, I've already had it there. They put a new head on the gear stick because they couldn't see anything. They didn't go back into the gearbox, but they looked around, see if they could see anything, you know, and then put a new head on. It did seem to improve it a little bit, but I'm still having the problem. It did definitely improve it, but I guess it is something in the gearbox itself, right?
Correct. You're going to have to take the transmission out and take it to the shop that rebuilt it.
Yeah. Is that something that could be repaired if I took it to you guys? Would it be, something to do or not?
We could take the transmission out and take the transmission to the fella that rebuilds the transmissions for us, and I'm sure he would find the problem. He's a very sharp guy.
Yeah. Okay. That's got to be pretty costly, right?
Well, I mean, you've got, you're going to have a couple thousand dollars in labor plus what he finds on the tranny.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks for the info, guys. I'm going to take it back to where I got it just to see what they're going to come up with. And I might wind up running it up there, yeah.
All right. Good luck.
Thank you.
All right. We're going to head off to Minnesota. Chris, it's your turn. Welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, guys. I'm on my way over to Peterbilt up here, and I'm going to start specking out a new truck. My question to you is, when I spec out a new motor, how do I want to get it set up, you know, money-wise, that comes to you guys and have you guys set everything up? You know, do I want like a 450 horse? I want to go all the way up to the 600 horse?
I would go to the 600. Ethan, what would you do?
Oh, I'd
go
right
to the
bigger horsepower
and then build from there.
Yeah, you can always go big.
Yeah, you can always turn it down. Yeah. It's some you may not be able to have the ability if you're going to buy a Cummins there. Again, the CPL is different based on the horsepower you spec. And the higher horsepower, as we've seen, they have the better parts, and they will let you do more work to it, more modifications.
Okay, yeah, because I'm going to spec out a Cummins. I just like the Cummins better than the Packard, personally. Because that will give me more options in transmissions to handle the higher torque, too.
Yes,
because that new automatic transmission is only rated for 1850 foot pounds of torque. Or if I go to the 600 horse and go up manual transmission, I can go to the 2050.
Yes.
Okay. Well, I actually just shut my doors, got loaded. Now I'm going to head down there and go spec out a new 579.
Congratulations.
Well, that sounds like fun. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
So it's always right. Nice to be able to go in and buy a brand new machine.
Yeah. Do you guys, now with the e-logs coming, and, you know, I think I'm going to have to run faster than I really want to. I was doing the math. The 264 gears and running it in 12th gear instead of 11th direct. Because it seems like direct in 264s, I'd have to run at almost 1,600 RPMs.
Why don't you look and see what they have that's close to a 250 gear ratio? And, Kevin, I wanted to call you and talk to you about that. Have you looked and seen what Eaton has lately on gear ratios?
No, I need to do that, but I'm with you, Bruce. There's some really high gear ratios available now, 230 range I've even seen. So I would sit down and still spec this to run in direct. Go ahead, John.
At the NACV show, I saw 195. They had it on display in the, I don't know if it was in the Eaton.
Wow.
It was in the Eaton or the Dana, booth. Yep.
Yeah, so I think you're going to have some options that are higher than a 264 that will allow you to run in direct and still have your overdrives. That's what I would be looking at. I'll go see what I can find on ratios. Thanks for joining us. We're all out of time. We'll do this again real soon. Check out the website. It's letstruck.com. Thanks to the guys from Pittsburgh Power for helping out. We'll see you next time. Be safe. Be profitable, be fit and healthy. Always do the hard work and master the journey. I'm Kevin Rutherford. All right, everybody, thanks for joining us. We'll see you back here tomorrow for Destination Health.